yesterday and
the day before. A particularly good workshop, I think. So today, so I'm going to pursue the story. So let me. So I'm going to spend some time recapitulating the story. So the story so far is that single cuts determine loop amplitudes. So it's good to have just the heuristic argument for why that's true, which I sort of skipped over in the past lectures, but let me now give the heuristic argument. So by that I mean, for instance, at one loop, the formula we had, so it was derived from contour integration, essentially. The one loop amplitude, would say, from external momenta and particles is equal to some phase space integral integrate over unshell particles of an amplitude with two more particles. And there's a one out here. So graphically, we just start from the loop. We start from any loop integral. These are propagators. And you cut one, so you put it on shell, and you have this factor integral here. Yes. You have a loop integral, put this guy on shell, and then you have an amplitude with two more particles to calculate. So there's a nice heuristic way to, sorry, I put 1/2. This is 1/2. There's a nice way to think about this formula, which is how actually Feynman derived, guessed it at first, is to consider the vacuum energy of the particles. So each particle in the vacuum has an energy EQ over 2. I can even put a factor of h bar here. And so what's the relation between the forward scattering amplitude and this energy? Well, what Feynman reasoned, what he was interested, for instance, is the physical quantity like the Lamb shift. So reason, suppose I have a gas, I have a box, some volume, I put in a bunch of hydrogen atoms, and I have, and there's a radiation field in that box. The radiation field in that box has this energy in its vacuum. Now he says, well, suppose I put the, because I have these atoms, the mode of the field will change because the dispersion relation of the photon is different when you have gas. It's not exactly as in vacuum. Speed of light is slightly different and slightly lower. And he said, well, what if, imagine I have this dilute gas of hydrogen atom in the 2p state and this other gas in the 2s state, how will the dispersion relation be different? And what measures this difference is the dispersion relation of the photon. But this dispersion relation of the photon in the dilute approximation is nothing but the forward amplitude of a photon scattering against this hydrogen atom and going backward. That's how the photon acquires the self-energy. It just scatters against this atom. And this is in the forward limit, Q. So the forward scattering amplitude tells you about how much the dispersion relation of your vacuum particles are changed. And if you want to put it in equation, the simplest way to think about it, the simplest way to get the factors right, is to imagine you had a you had a mass term to your Lagrangian. So if you had a mass term, then just by insert, then you have a forward amplitude that's just a mass insertion. But let's say I have a scalar field. You have a mass insertion, and then the forward amplitude is, from this diagram, is equal to m squared. So the forward scattering amplitude is literally the change in the mass square of the particle. So if you add, so let's rewrite this as 1/2 EQ, and this energy, when you have this shift, is equal to EQ leading order plus delta M square over 2 EQ. Oops. So this is the energy shift of the vacuum fluctuations. And this formula is nothing but 1/2 D3Q 2π3 2 EQ times the change in the mass square. And if we then substitute this change in the mass square with the forward scattering amplitude, we get exactly this formula. This formula is just weighting the change in the vacuum energy of the particles. Yeah. No. 1, 2. Yeah. So this 1/2 is important. Another thing we learned from this heuristic argument is if we have fermions, well, for a fermion, the energy, the vacuum energy is minus EQ over 2. So we learned that there should be a minus for every fermion.
Sorry, I'm just slightly confused. Yes. Why are you adding the forward scattering amplitude, which is delta m squared over 2e, why are you adding that to E0? Why should I add a forward scattering amplitude to an energy?
Exactly, because the forward scattering amplitude is the leading order change in dispersion relation. So the energy, the dispersion relation is the link. Yeah. And if we did this so the vacuum has bosons in it, but there are also fermions in it, and of course we have to sum over all particles in the vacuum. But fermions have opposite sign for the vacuum energy. It says here we have to sum over all particles weighted by a minus sign for fermion. Now, this is dependent spin. Well, this is the one new formula. And as I explained in the first lecture, if you're careful with the I epsilons in this integral, and which you can do if you work with retarded boundary conditions, then this is all you need to calculate this object. So now I want to, how do we use this most efficiently to calculate scattering?
So, can you just elaborate on the I epsilon?
Oh, yeah, this is a long story.
Okay.
It took me.
Sorry, I missed the previous two lectures.
Yeah.
You've already done that.
Yeah, we can talk about that later. So, question is, how do we use it most efficiently in computation? So, in the past lecture, I've seen that, well, one way to use it is to say, well, we know that there's such a thing as an integral. You can always write the any old, say, one scattering amplitude can be expressed as some over object that looks like, that our integral, d4q, good old off-shell integrals. And we know that if these off-shell integrals have all the right single cuts, we're going to get the right answer. So we can match. Strategy one is match our single cuts to reconstruct the off-shell loop integrand starting from this off-shell data.
This is one strategy. But it kind of turns into a big linear algebra problem if you stop doing it. Basically, you have to list, you have to make an ansatz for what the loop amplitude is, compute the single cut of the starting from this forward amplitude, and match the two. So there's no way to proceed without making an ansatz. And then you have to solve Borel's coefficient. And today I'm going to discuss a different way, which is to use recursion relation, which are going to be much more explicit. That's recursion relation.
These have already been discussed quite beautifully by Freddie and Nima in lectures here 2 weeks ago. So I'm going to cover, I'm probably going to say pretty much the same thing, but I'm going to use a different language. So try to be, they were really focused on n equals 4, which is where this has been applied so far. But we aren't interested in moving to QCD. So I try to use a less n equals 4 centric language. So the workhorse in this is the BCFW idea. So first thing I should recall what BCFW does at tree level. Basic idea is that the scattering amplitude at tree level, it's just a rational function. It has poles, but no branch cuts or anything. Just have poles. And when you want to reconstruct this function from these poles, it depends on many, many variables, so you cannot really use single variable calculus, and it's a tough problem in general. But what this person found, Brito, Cacciaggio, Feng, and Witten, they found that this single, you can introduce, if you have an amplitude, P1, Pn, you can deform it into an amplitude that depends on a single complex parameter. Single complex parameter, of course, and this deform amplitude depends on two, let me shift P2 and Pn. Depend on, so basically you, the simplest way to deform an amplitude is, you have to deform some of the momenta, and you cannot deform just one because that wouldn't conserve momentum, but you can deform two. And the deformation is P1 goes to P1 plus ZQ. I shouldn't use Q here. Let me call this object mu. So this is a four vector. And now P1 is constrained. P1 has to stay on shell every time. So that requires basically that mu square is a null vector and that mu dot P1 is 0 equal to mu dot Pn. And you can always find solutions to this constraint. So you have a one parameter family of deformation. I'm going to speed up a little bit. And the best, very powerful way of doing that is to solve explicitly this constraint is to use the spinor-Lisztig formalism. If P1 is null, you can always write P1, well, any four vector P1 can be written as a four matrix, which is basically, P slash alpha alpha dot, which is a, if this is the Weyl equation, you have a 2x2 matrix, and you can write P slash, and that's a way of writing P. So I'm going to have those two indices. And if P is null, that tells you that this 2x2 matrix is as rank 1, because P square is 0, matrix square to 0. That tells you that if P is null, then P is a product of two spinors. Those two spinors are just the solution to the Dirac equation, to the Weyl equation. And this decomposition is very powerful, because then you can write that, you can make the explicit choice that mu is simply equal to lambda 1 lambda n bar. And the reason that's clever is this vector is automatically orthogonal to p1, because mu slash p1 slash gives this, and same thing, it's orthogonal to pn, so you just solve that. And it's useful to view the amplitude as a function of the lambdas and not of the p, instead of the p's, and then this just becomes lambda 1 goes to lambda 1 plus, lambda 1 is the one that's not changed, this becomes just lambda n goes to lambda n minus the lambda 1, and lambda bar 1 goes to lambda bar 1 plus the lambda bar n. So it's a very simple deformation of on these vial spinners. And the remarkable claim is that in gauge theory, so we have this amplitude AZ that depends on one complex parameter. Most of you are familiar with this story, but it's useful to recount it. Recount it here before we go to loop level. So we have this function AZ. We're interested in AZ when Z equal to 0, so the undeformed amplitude. So we can always write that A is equal to integral dz over z, 1 over 2 pi I of az. Well, I've done nothing, I'm just look right. This is the definition of a at z equals 0. And this contour is just supposed to be a small circle around the origin. So the function az has a number of poles in the complex plane, are nothing but which come from propagators in Feynman diagrams. For instance, the propagator 1 over p1 plus p2 plus p3 square gets deformed to this, and this object is linear in z. Z mu dot p1 p2 p3. So each propagator gets deformed like this. It's just linear because mu square is 0. So each of these propagator gives you a pole somewhere in the complex plane. Now, what you want to do, the next step, is just deform this contour. And just by using Cauchy theorem, evaluate this contour integral in terms of integral over all other poles. But then, when you do this deformation, a priori, there's also contribution from big circle at infinity. So this is a completely general statement about complex functions. And what they've shown, the remarkable fact is that if you choose the spin of the particle you're deforming appropriately, or put differently, if you're interested in amplitude with fixed spins, if you choose the particle you're deforming in the right way, this term is zero. And the physical principle, at the simplest level, It really has to do with spin. For a scalar particle, for instance, in phi fourth particle, this term is zero if the amplitude goes to zero at infinity. And the heuristic reason why this can work when you have spin is that you can consider the physical picture is you have two momenta very large. When z is large, your momenta is essentially z mu, and you have this particle flying on top of a background. It's interacting with it at some tree-level interaction. And the basic idea is that you have to look at this. If you look at some sort of spin-flip transition, that's going to vanish at infinity. So it really has to do with spin. If you didn't have the spin, that wouldn't work. But with the spin, you can focus on relevant amplitude. This is a bit oversimplified, but there's a precise criterion for when amplitude vanish or not. But in QCD, you can always find amplitude deformations which vanish at infinity. So this can be used to calculate amplitude very efficiently. And the reason this is efficient, or the reason it's called a recursion relation, is that each of these terms comes from a propagator in a Feynman diagram. We have some tree diagram. It comes from setting a propagator to zero. And this term is just a product of two lower point unshelled tree amplitude. The formula is just An equal to a sum over all channels, something on the left, 1 over p squared. So the channel are, so particle 1 is on one side, particle n is on the other side, and p is the sum in that channel. So p is the sum of all momenta on the left. And ar evaluated at shifted location. This p, this p1, pi plus p at the shifted location. And same thing for, oh, that was the L. Same thing for the R. Let me just rewrite. So this is a very fast way of calculating tree amplitude, much faster than using Feynman rules. And it's completely recursive. Yeah. So, well, we want to use this at loop level, we want to use this at loop level.
The shifted P with the Z?
Yeah. So shifted P to the, sorry, P act. So P act, so this P1, P2, Pi, so P act for instance is P1 at plus P2 plus P plus da 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 Pi. So yeah, it's the sum of everything here, and P1 at is just P1 plus Z0 on this pole, with Z evaluated on this pole. So it recurs, but it sort of evaluates amplitude at shifted location. So we want to do this at loop level. The obvious objection to this is that loop level in amplitude is not a rational function anymore. It has branch cuts, logs. It's not a nice function. But what you can try to do is do it for the loop integral. And this fits perfectly in this philosophy, because here we're reconstructing irrational function from its poles, and we understand its poles, and here, well, if we understand its poles, we're going to construct the loop integral. So there's one thing we have to say first. So what is a loop integral? Is it a well-defined function? In a random theory, so loop integral depends on an integration variable q, which is just some dummy variable. And a random theory, the sort of object contains would be say p1 squared, would be some propagator q squared, q plus p1 squared, q plus p1 plus p2. You might see an object like that. And then
Well, you might get another object that's one over Q squared, P3 squared, Q plus P4.
A sum of terms that look like that. But in each of these terms, Q is a dummy variable. So how do I add those terms together? I can shift this, I can write this equivalency as 1 over Q plus P1 squared, Q plus P3 plus P1, and you get the idea. I can shift this as I want. How do I add those guys? So in general, if you don't have a function, how do we even get started in this business? And for this reason, I'm going to restrict to planar gauge theorems. So the important point I want to make is that in planar gauge theory, there's a natural origin so that you can put all these terms on the same under the same integration sign. This is completely kinematic. So in the planar gauge theory, what you can do is, in any gauge theory, you can expand amplitude over the color trace. So each amplitude is proportional to something. You have some Gruan amplitude. They have colors A1, A2. You can expand them over different color traces. And you have to sum over the permutation of the color of these things. And in each case, you have a proportional amplitude for each of these ordering. But when you fix an ordering of the colors, you sum over permutation of this lab. In the planar gauge theory, so once you decided to look at the given partial amplitude, then there's a natural order for. There's a precise meaning when I say P1, P2, P3, etc. And this is that they are ordered along the color trace. Then if I have a one loop diagram, I can use double line notation. I can introduce the concept of a region momenta. So suppose I declare that. When you have the structure, you can introduce auxiliary coordinates, call them x1, x2, x3, which are defined by the property that pi is equal to xi minus xi minus 1. This introducing this variable is canonical in a planar gauge theory because you have a natural ordering for these guys. And the good thing about that is that it solves momentum conservation for you, as long as the x's are cyclically identified. It solves momentum conservation. The x are only defined up to translation, so you basically trade the four constraints to four symmetries. So everything works out. You can do that, it's canonical. And then the thing is, so if I have a, let me draw a better diagram like that. So if I have a diagram, a scalar diagram that looks like that. This is a planar diagram. This is P1, P2, P3. Before, the thing you do, you just write your x1, x2, x3, x4, and let's call this. So naturally, you see that the x's are associated with regions, and this momenta here is the difference when you go from one region to the other. So naturally, if I write a diagram like that, I would be inclined to say that, well, the momentum in this propagator is this difference, so that I will write this canonically as d4 x prime over x prime minus x1 square, x prime minus x2 square,
n up to x prime minus x4 squared. And this is completely equivalent to the usual way of writing as d4q, that would be d4q over q squared, q plus p2 squared, q plus p2 plus p3 squared. It's completely equivalent, except that now there's a no way to shift the x prime. If I declare that this particular denominator looks like that, once I fix what x1 is, completely unambiguous, and if I have some other diagram, like some triangle, P1, P2, P3, if I have any other diagrams, I can put it canonically, I can then add them together canonically. So in the planar theory, the integrand, you can sum all the Feynman diagrams, and you get a well-defined function. That's good. So we have a well-defined function. It has poles. We know to construct its poles from single cuts. Let's compute it. Let me get the tree level. Let me erase some of this. Yeah, let's do exactly the same BCFW computation, but now for the one loop integrand. This is not.
These expressions for different diagrams.
Yeah.
Because they're secretly not really different diagrams. There's only one diagram. If you write it in your double line notation, all those diagrams are the same. You're assigning rather strange facts.
Yeah, you're saying in string theory they're all the same diagram.
Right.
Right. In string theory it's this endless diagram.
So when it comes to a non plane. If you tell me the ordering around the external, around the outside of your universe and which guys you're putting on the inside, and maybe I can combine all the ones from individual sort of
there are some running on the genus, aren't they? So I guess the point is that there are some loops.
Well, you've got it as an annulus, but some of the guys from the inside.
Yeah. Well, you have a good point. For instance, string theory definitely suggests that there might be something to do in a non-planar case. So for this lecture, I'm going to stick to the planar case, basically because in that case, I already know what I'm doing.
But one loop guys, when you put them inside and outside, when you want the coupling identities are related to the ones where you only have guys outside. So it's completely irrelevant. The guys with legs inside or outside is not useful.
That is true. It's so only had two loops.
Non-planar really means the topology of the diagram when you remove the external particles is that non-planar.
Yeah. I think this is a good point. In a gauge theory, at one loop, planar versus non-planar doesn't mean anything.
It doesn't mean anything.
You know the planar answer, you know the whole one loop. The two loops should start to mean something.
But the point is you also may not have as many regions as you've got loops.
But still, it suggests that...
This is a good point. I mean, at one loop, so if we think we're on a gauge theory, then there should be something to do, just because we know that the planar answer determines the whole answer. This is lecture, so I'm just gonna stick to what is completely understood so far.
You made me sit through BCFW.
Yeah. So in the planar case, we understand completely that there's a canonical integral.
No.
Yeah. If we do this deformation, so general diagram, say it would be some tree, and it's going to have some loop somewhere, that could be here. That is
some diagram here. Suppose I put that P1 is here, PN here, P1 is here. I'm asking about what are the poles of this object. Well, I would get a certain number of poles which are exactly as before. So the tree on one side, But now there's a one loop amplitude, one loop integrand sitting on the other side. So at one loop, well, I get exactly this formula, except that now I get a term in which this is one loop, which is 3. And this is the one loop integrand that depends on the loop momentum Q, which is now off shell and generic. I get another term in which it's exactly the same sum over channels, 1 over p square, but now with the right hand side amplitude, that's one loop. And now it's this one that depends on Q. So I get those two sort of terms. Yeah.
Oh, this is the level of the integrand. Sorry.
So we can only do that for the integrand because the integral has branch cuts and it's too complicated. And other people have tried. So there are terms like this, and the only sort of thing we're missing are terms in which we are cutting the guy inside the loop. So there's going to be a third term to this sum. So this is, if there were just those two terms, then there would be no loops at all, because you could recursively break down everything to three-point function, something really small where there's no loop. We need some sinth term. Nima likes to call it inhomogeneous, let me just continue like this. What's this inhomogeneous term? Well, it's our friend the single cut. So more precisely, the single cut depends on the null momentum. But here, our loop momentum is completely off-shell. So why is it on-shell? Just because this loop momentum here, remember that this is a planar diagram, it's really we're making this deformation with x fixed. And this loop momentum here is x minus xn. And the BCF deformation, if we write it in the x variable, the BCF just acts the form of those two. And the BCF deformation is just xn, one like that above, just e xn goes to xn minus z mu, and all other on chain. So you're just moving this region momenta that changes pn and p1, such a way that momentum is conserved, and all the other region momenta are unchanged. So this propagator here, which is 1 over x prime minus xn hat, becomes null at some point. So we have to evaluate the forward amplitude when this is null. So the inhomogeneous term, let me write it for you. This term is simply 1 over x prime minus xn squared times, so now we're opening this to evaluate the residue, and now we should just have a forward scattering amplitude, which is just a single A with two more particles, three level. And let's view it as a function of x, depends on x1, xn, xn is shifted. So what are all the regions in this object? This is the region xn was here. There's a region xn here, there's a region x prime, there's a region xn, x1. So the forward limit means in this coordinate is. So we have to evaluate this object, and when xn is just xn plus minus z0 mu, such that xn at minus x prime squared is 0, so that this is how. So if we do one loop BCFW in a planar theory, well, we can construct the integral from just those three terms. And that's completely recursive, closed form, to the extent that you can calculate this for tree amplitude, which is what I'm going to turn to next. Are there any questions at this stage? This is basically listing all the singularities of this object. Yeah, so mu is a Kolowajczak deformation.
And so on whatever it was, we were seeing that to compute this forward limit of the tree, we're doing it by introducing some sort of auxiliary BCFW shift and essentially So that's still buried inside a tree coordinate, that's not being made.
So at this point I haven't said anything about how you're going to compute a tree. In practice, we know that since we have this nice technology going on, well, why not compute a tree itself recursive? But so far, this is just some object that's well defined in itself.
I'm supposed to be worried. If I didn't know other things, we would have to be worried that we've got two arguments the same in the entry. That is the problem.
Yes, exactly. It's not at all clear that this forward limit actually exists. Because in general, you will have coordinate of singularities. Well, so far, that is what is so far understood in the literature regarding this technique. In the planar case, there's Kanner integral and there's this term. That's formally true always. But then we have to evaluate this. And what is known regarding this object in the literature is that we only know how to evaluate this object really when we have n equals 1 smooth. We don't. So this is the next thing I want to turn on. So there are many problems if you just try to calculate this in general theory. The first thing you might be worried about when you have those two momenta passing to each other, that well, you might get path fault somewhere in the diagram, and so this is q, this is minus q, this is zero momentum, and well, that would come from opening a diagram like that, but if I just send you a tree amplitude, you would be worried that this limit is a tadpole that blows up in your face. Another thing you would be worried about is if you have just one leg, you have something that looks like a self energy inserted on the leg, such as P, then this propagator here is 1 over P squared, which is 1 over 0, and that is also blows up in your face. So this forward limit is very singular. So lots of this issue has been discussed quite a lot, and I don't think there's any satisfactory solution so far for QCD. And the one way to proceed, as is explained in the my paper, loops and trees, is when you have supersymmetry, supersymmetry is limited by scalar.
The way this works is simply that in supersymmetry, you will have a Gaugino here. First thing I should talk about this. When you have supersymmetry, tadpoles beautifully cancel. The only sort of tadpoles you might get in the supersymmetric theory. I don't think I have time to list, to go through the careful argument. So the argument is two parts. First, you show that the tadpoles cancel in SUSY. And the second is to show that. And basically, here, this diagram in QCD, you wouldn't even include normally because it's proportional to F, A, B, C, which is anti-symmetric in the two. And those two have the same colors. So normally, you just from the color factor, you would just drop it. The important thing is that the self-energy insertion looking diagram also cancel. And here, you really need all three of them. There's also a Bosnick part of the four-point function. So there's some nice SUSY cancellation between the two. And basically, this is something you can check just by working out what this. If you just look at this part of the diagram, this is a four-point function of two gluon goes to two gluon, the forward limit. And this is just some so basically this matrix element is for gluon goes to gluon, GG goes to GG. It's a sum of terms that are like S over T, S over U, U over S. Some of terms like that. Some of them are singular, and the forward limit T goes to zero. But just by the color structure, they're not. The color structure cancels them, and you just have these guys, which in the forward limit are equal to one. This matrix element just goes to one, forward limit, basically. And the same for this. But this comes with a minus sign, and it perfectly, identically cancels. Both of them. Yeah. No, it's not a matter. So I'm going to give you. Yeah. If you wait 5 minutes, that should become very clear. Yeah. Okay. So, okay, I can. Okay, the object seems to exist, everything. Let's do something concrete and give a prescription for calculating this object that is useful. So we know the object obeys recursion relations. Ultimately, we want to evaluate this object using recursion relations. So let's just give a recursive definition of this object, which makes it clear that it's well defined. The sort of deformation you can look at is, so you have this amplitude that depends on P1, PM, Q, minus Q. One very canonical deformation of this is to deform Q. Let's just take Q goes to Q plus Z. Now let's not call it mu, let's call the vector mu. And now you just have to deform this guy and this guy by exactly opposite amounts. You just have to write this and momentum is conserved. And all you need to impose is that mu square 0 is equal to mu dot q. So there are many, many vectors. At for a given q, there are many, many vectors which obey this property. If you do this deformation, so it's a bit, logically you have to avoid circular loops. The first thing you show, avoid circular loops, you can first show that this limit exists from some argument. And then, so then we have to evaluate, we want to consider this function as a function of the z. Let me call this w, because not to confuse it with the z above. It's a new, the second BCF deformation. So we have to understand what this function looks like as a function of w. Which, think about it, is we have this Q at going in, going out, momenta. All of the poles of this function correspond simply to cutting some other propagator in the loop. So all the poles of this function are nothing but the unitarity cuts. Well, the two cuts of the, yeah.
At the moment, it still looks like it's an important limit, just for the Q hat.
Yeah, everything's forward, yes. Yeah. So I'm assuming, so first you have to show that this is well defined for any Q. Yeah.
So it's still the forward limit, it's just a different Q than it was to the limit. So your BCF relationship hasn't taken you away from the forward limit.
No, no. Yes, you're right. I'm staying the forward limit. Yes. The good thing is that there's a. The good thing about this deformation here is that all of the terms on the that will appear, all of the poles that you will get, will bring you into products of two amplitudes, and each of them there's no longer any forward limit to take. So there's a technically complicated step to take the forward limit, and by using this explicit BCFW deformation, BCFW-like, you can avoid. So this gives you, yeah, I read the app here. You can write this simply as sum over, let's call this particle pi plus 1. And, well, since we've been discussing the planar limit, let's say in the planar limit, so the sum over channel is just a sum over I. So this left-handed amplitude that depends on Q at, well, should be pi plus 1. That's sort of picture. This is, yeah. This is the right picture. There's this amplitude on the right, that is Q at P1, PI plus 1. Times, let's call this guy M and minus M. Sorry, I'm writing it. That's P plus 1, dot, 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 PN, PN is shifted, P1 is shifted. No, I'm sorry. Sorry, this has nothing to do with the other one. I'm evaluating this. So this is not shifted, just this is shifted. You're watching me. This is not shifted, but let me put an at on M just to emphasize that it's a new dummy variable. And then there's a Q. Good. This is term, and then just divided by 1 over
plus all the way to. Pi squared. What is this term? Some realicities as usual. Whatever. So you have to evaluate this unitary decay at this shifted location. So now, in the earlier discussion, this sort of, we know that this sort of argument only works when there's no pole at infinity. Yeah. So this explicit expression is given in the paper Loops and Trees, if you want to look at it more carefully. Yeah. What I could show in that paper is that in N equals 1 SUSY, this deformation actually vanishes at infinity. So there's nothing but those terms. The proof goes in two steps. First, show that the forward limit exists, and then you show that it vanishes at infinity, and you have this expression. And once you have this expression, then you can completely forget about forward limits or solidities like that. This you can evaluate straight, no solidity. So it's a closed form, sort of. Close form on the answer. Yeah. So, well, yeah. Oh, good. Yeah. So, oh, it's important to vanish because otherwise it's a term. Yeah. So the reason, yeah. So if you do it in QCD, the thing is you will get the. If you want to do that in QCD, basically, you will have your loop particle flying around. You will have the iconal contribution, and the iconal contribution is actually linear in W. Not only it doesn't vanish, it blows up infinity. But the iconal contribution is the same among superpartners. So the iconal piece cancels. And what is true but non-trivial is that the subleading iconal also cancel. So there's those two cancellations. It's SUSY. Yeah, that's why it works. Yeah. So I think I'm gonna pretty much exhausted my time. So I'm gonna leave with the negative size. Merge those two formulas. So in the paper with Nima, Kenny Ahmed, Freddy Cacheso, and Jacob here, and Yaroslav, we've solved it for, and we've actually did it for n equal 4, and not just at one loop, but at higher loop, which proved very powerful. One thing we can just say, which is just clear from this construction, is that any symmetry of the trees, and this is just, we're just showing to clear trees, any symmetries of the trees is expected to go into symmetry of the loop integrand. So this makes all the symmetries of any theory completely manifest. Up to, and then you have to regulate and do things which may break symmetries, but a priori, conformal invariance, everything is then manifest in the integrand. So we've done it for n equals 4, so if I want to give an exercise, well, I might suggest doing it for n equals 1. So it's not been tried so far, but the argument is strong, and I'm willing to stick my neck out that it's going to work. Yeah, that this gives the standard answer. Yeah, well, for those that have been computed, but for the new ones too. Yeah, yes. So at two loop, at two loop, what is true is in a planar theory, you can still define an integrand, but then you have to symmetrize with respect to the two loops. So you have two, you have x prime prime. Or your region remember. If you symmetrize it, you have a well-defined function. And Well, you can do the same. So in this formula, we add, to be more explicit, there's this trivial extension of this formula that tells you here you will distribute your loops all the ways along the two terms, and the inimages term is just loop minus one. So there's a trivial extension of the formula to higher loops for the n-tagram.
Which is the right answer, is it?
Sorry? Seems artificial?
So no. I'm just saying, is it obvious that if you symmetrize the integrand, then yeah, it still gives the right answer?
Let's think a little bit. But no, it is. Well, first of all, you're forced to symmetrize because otherwise you don't have a well-defined function.
Well, they can rotate around each other as you do. Yeah, so I can see.
If you don't symmetrize, there's no way to have different diagrams because then. You have a lot of different topologies. How do you choose which guys on the left, which guys on the right?
Yeah, that's right.
You absolutely have to symmetrize just to get the well-defined function. Mm. That's forced upon you.
Mm.
No choice. And then you just have to set up the recursion relation in such a way that the symmetry is preserved. So you explicitly symmetrize about steps and guarantee to have the right answer.
And
by
any story, you know that this four limits exists
for all loops. Yeah, so then it's not so right. As what you're pointing out is, I mean, that's just something that has not been tough about. So, suffice there. So if I want to do this a two loop, then I need to take a forward limit of the one loop integral. That has not been allowed. We just observed that in n equals 4, nothing got wrong. The forward loop. Basically, you have all these supersymmetries. You always get 0 to the 4th over 0 with this limit. There's just nothing which can go wrong in n equals 4. But in other theories, I mean, it's not been really tough to
choose. But is there a proof in n equals 4 that nothing goes wrong? Because I know I've got all these supersymmetries, but maybe I've.
I don't know. I know we didn't run into problem up to five loops. That will go. Now, if you want, we don't have an abstract proof. I mean, we try it and obviously we're going to run into a problem. No, but there are these. I mean, as I said, you can worry about that, but as I said, there's always this expression like involving unitarity cuts that express the answer in terms of manifestly finite and well-defined term. So okay, but let me say so. Exercise. Let me put this in quote as sort of direction for future research. As I've come up in the discussion, and as it's becoming increasingly suggested by BCG relations and Lieberman's work on non-planar theories, there's got to be something to do with non-planar theories. It's just that we have to think hard. That's a big step we have to take. And the other thing is. Go to non-Suzy. Basically, we want to get to QCD as fast as we can. That's the most. That's an interesting theory. And of course, it was interesting too. But it would be good if we could get people interested if we would go to QCD. So, and the thing is, you see, this formula here, it's not strictly speaking right in QCD because there's this term at infinity that we've dropped. But, I mean, it's basically probably 99% of the right answer, right? So there's something to think, but we're not infinitely far away from the right answer. And but in non-Suzy theories, there's also the issue that we have to really carefully regulate to get rational terms, which is maybe just like rational terms.
Which is very subtle, for instance, in QCD, you calculate the one loop amplitude with just with 4 plus electricity gluons. In QCD, that's not zero. If you try to use a single cut, well, the single cut, you will have an amplitude like that, and the single cut is zero. So naively using the single cut formalism, you would guess that the all plus is zero, which is, of course, wrong. But the reason it's wrong is that you have to regulate the integrand here. And when you evaluate it in Dirac, this amplitude here is not really zero. This amplitude here, there's a, in Dirac, you have gluons, and they also have two epsilon extrascalars. And the epsilon extrascalars in the loop give you a non-zero answer. So everything works out, but it's just more subtle. So having an efficient formula for the rational term is definitely an important open problem. Thank you.